Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Education Finance Division of the Minnesota House. We do or do not have a quorum yet. Do not. So we'll begin the day's agenda with the commissioner. Commissioner Ricker, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I trust you've found your office, found the bathroom in the building, found the parking ramps, and found the heater in the car?
That's right.
Very good.
Exactly. Although my car is not really happy with me these last couple days, but it sounds like everybody's experiencing the same thing. So,
I was the beneficiary of the Minnesota tradition of helping the guy standing in the street with the jumper cables this morning.
That's right.
Very pleased with that tradition right now.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So welcome to the committee. This is your first time before the Education Finance Division. Appreciate your taking the time out of your busy schedule. Introduce yourself. You're, I'm sure, known to many of us, but less known to some others, and it's an opportunity primarily for us to get to know you and maybe for you to get to know us a little bit. So if you'd please state your name for the record and proceed.
I will, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I am a licensed secondary English language arts teacher in the state of Minnesota, serving as Commissioner of Education. And I want to thank you very much for your time today and for finding some time on your calendar, on your schedule, to give me some time to just introduce myself, and I'm certainly happy to stay for questions if you would like them as well. I'll start with just a little bit of biographical background to share with you. And as some of you may know, and one of you knows for sure, because we graduated a year apart from each other, but I grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota. And after graduating, I went to the University of St. Thomas here in St. Paul and fell in love with the city of St. Paul and the neighborhoods and the students in their classrooms as I did my student teaching at St. Paul Central. But my first teaching offer for a full-time job was in St. Cloud, Minnesota at South Junior High. And I took it, and that is when I fell in love with the middle-level philosophy, with middle-level students, and with the middle-level curriculum, and everything about teaching 7th and 8th graders. And after teaching in St. Cloud for a couple years, my husband got a job in Washington State, so we moved out to the Pacific Northwest, where I taught for 3 years. And after that, I had an offer to teach English in Seoul, South Korea for a year. And so I took that opportunity to teach in Seoul, South Korea for a year. My husband and I went over there for the year, and we came back, and I got my middle school teaching job back in St. Cloud, but at North Junior High instead, which was an incredible experience as well. After 2 years, my husband got a teaching job offer in St. Paul Public Schools, and so we decided to move to St. Paul, and I got a teaching job again at the middle level, and taught on the east side of St. Paul until 2005, in the spring of 2005. Actually, in the fall of 2004, I earned my national board certification after spending a year working on it. And then in the spring of 2005, I actually ran for president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers and won. And so I left my classroom to be a full-time president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers. And while I was at the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, I shifted our focus from being a service model union to being one that focused on teaching and learning. And my goal during that time was to make our contract the most powerful document our district had to attract and retain a high-quality, diverse workforce that knew how to meet the needs of our students. And so that's where our work was focused. And in 2014, AFT President Randy Weingarten asked me to run with her for her re-election, but to ask me to run for election as Executive Vice President as part of her ticket, and I ran and I won. And so I had been Executive Vice President of AFT. My focus at AFT had been helping to run the AFT's Innovation Fund, which was our fund where we used a portion of our budget to modestly invest in promising educational practices, where our unions were coming together with their districts and with community partners to invest in something, invest in a promising educational practice that they had recognized their community needed. I had been the beneficiary of one of these Innovation Fund grants in 2009 when I submitted a grant application asking to create asking to tap into Minnesota's then new alternative certification law to create our own grow your own alternative certification program within St. Paul Public Schools that would work on diversifying teaching as well as filling hard to staff license areas. And so I was very familiar with the Innovation Fund. So when President Weingarten asked me to run it, we took modest grants where a local union would write a grant in partnership with their district, so it was a labor management collaboration, and with at least one community partner, if not several. While I ran the grant, our focus in investment was on career and technical education, and community schools, and civics and democracy education. My other portfolio included working on immigration and refugee children issues. That included supporting English language learner services, that included supporting the Seal of Biliteracy and helping educate our members to promote the Seal of Biliteracy in their states, among other things. And then, as you know, in December of 2018, then Governor-elect Walz and Lieutenant Governor-elect Flanagan asked me to serve as Commissioner of Education. And so here I am. Really, one of the consistent focuses of my career, whether that be my career as a teacher, as someone pursuing my national board certification, in my advocacy roles, has really been listening, learning from what I hear, and shaping my work going forward based on what I have heard and what I have learned. My work on professionalism throughout my career has been an example of this. A continued focus to diversifying our education workforce is imperative. When we worked on career teacher, for example, we spent a lot of time listening. I conducted listening sessions across my district of teachers of color and indigenous teachers who are already teaching in St. Paul Public Schools, asking them questions about what their journey was into teaching and their license area and their subject matter if they were a subject matter teacher, and learning from them and then shaping what our licensure program should look like and how to fill hard to staff license areas and how to attract and retain teachers of color and indigenous teachers based on their work helping me shape that. The example of the work we're doing on professionalism as well, and the idea that part of the retention of teachers is to like recognize the professional responsibilities they can and should have and the professional responsibilities that land somewhere else in education, like at the building principal level or at the superintendency level, for example. And so part of that was listening and asking educators about what is it about their jobs that make them feel like a professional, right? What are those things they do that feel like they are tapping into their professional expertise and they are helping to shape the work that better meets the needs of students? Then asking them what are some of the barriers to feeling that way or doing those things, and then asking them if they have ever worked to overcome those barriers, what I could learn from their work in breaking down barriers to feeling like a professional and feeling like your expertise is tapped in your work. And so this pattern of listening, learning from what I hear, and then shaping my work forward has really been constant in my entire career. And I also want to say that one of the areas of expertise I have also developed is that really got its start when I was a teacher in St. Cloud, and my my principal asked me to develop an expertise in brain-based learning so that I could start leading some of our professional development work and supporting teachers as a full-time classroom teacher, and still doing this. And that was, that left an imprint on me for a few different reasons. One, it was an example of that professionalism, right? That my administrator saw an area of expertise that I could develop, supported me to develop it, and then also didn't ask me to leave my classroom to do it. I was able to exhibit that leadership, able to exhibit that contribution to my profession and to growing the expertise of my colleagues while still being a classroom teacher. And that experience, again, sort of listening, learning what I needed to learn about how to best meet the needs of the adults, my colleagues, and then shaping my work based on that. It also taught me that we need to support and expand leadership opportunities for classroom teachers who don't want to leave our classroom practice, who absolutely want that to be still a foundation of what they do, but still have incredible expertise to share with their colleagues, or incredible expertise to share with student teachers or to share with the field in general. It's one of the reasons while I was president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, before the legislature enacted the annual evaluation law, support and evaluation law, that I negotiated that any educator who was going to host a student teacher, who was going to look for a teacher on special assignment position, who was going to be a consulting teacher in our peer assistance and review program, have a current evaluation on file within the last 12 months that would be part of what they submitted as their application process. And peer assistance and review is another example of listening to what the field is saying, in this case my colleagues, in this case new teachers, and learning from what I heard and then shaping my work going forward. And one of the things I heard consistently, both as a classroom teacher and in my leadership experiences, was that our new teachers very often felt like they weren't as supported as they could be as new teachers, that their evaluation system perhaps felt either erratic or they didn't completely understand it. And additionally, in listening to teachers, when they were struggling, they weren't sure where to go for help. You know, when they were told that that a principal had concerns about their performance, they weren't necessarily sure where they could always go. In some buildings, there was a very robust, like, collegial support system, and in other buildings, that just didn't exist. It was sporadic. And then also hearing from educators that, you know, as they moved on in their work, they didn't want to stumble. So, for example, as a licensed English teacher, I'm licensed 7 through 12. As you heard, the vast majority of my experience has been the middle level. If my district needs me to teach 10th or 11th grade English, I actually don't want to stumble as I relearn how to meet the needs of high school students versus middle school students. Additionally, we heard that in listening to educators want to pursue their expertise, that when an educator would pursue their National Board certification, they wanted a support system, they wanted help, understanding. St. Paul had a very early and robust National Board support program where when they had a cohort model, they had a number of teachers seeking to pursue board certification. And when that cohort model went away, the number of teachers seeking board certification dropped as well. And so teachers were saying that if we had that support, if we had that understanding, we would be much more interested in pursuing our board certification. I know personally, in 2003 and 2004, when I knocked on doors of my colleagues to see if anyone wanted to pursue board certification with me or at least explore it, I got a number of teachers who said, I just, you know, I am not sure without the true support, I'm ready to do that. And so I ended up pursuing it on my own, although no one ever pursues their board certification on their own. I do have to say that there were colleagues of mine that I met through the Minnesota Council of Teachers of English, because I've been active in MCE TE since starting teaching in Minnesota, who had already earned their board certification. And I know Marlena Dietrich's old line about it's the friends you can call at 2 a.m. that matter. I found out through earning my board certification, it's the colleagues you can email at 2 a.m. who answer your emails about a half hour later who really matter to that support system. And so that is all to say, as I listened to those stories, as I had those experiences, I shaped peer assistance and review in St. Paul differently than maybe you've heard of it in its inception in Toledo, Ohio, and other places. And that was that we insisted on growing it into a full-spectrum peer assistance and review program. So we started with just a little bit of the America Reinvestment Recovery Act money. I think it was about $300,000. We started it by making sure that we invested in achievement of tenure process that had no surprises, no accidents, that it was an intentional achievement of tenure process for our new teachers, and that everyone was supported to go through peer assistance and review. There was a parallel track that as your administrator evaluated you, you also had this consulting teacher working alongside you, also doing some evaluation of your work, giving you feedback on all sorts of your classroom practice. And then after growing that for a couple years, we added the peer assistance and review component for struggling teachers, teachers who had been identified in need of improvement, so that if a teacher wanted to, they could tap into a consulting teacher for their support as they worked to improve their practice as their administrator was evaluating them, determining whether they would keep their job or not. And then the last component we introduced to peer assistance and review to make it full spectrum was that any teacher could have access to a consulting teacher if they were changing grade levels, for example, and wanted to make sure they didn't miss a beat with our students, that they had an opportunity to hit the ground running. If they were changing license areas, as you know, a number of our educators are dual licensed or hold more than one license, or if they were looking to earn their national board certification, or they were looking, or they were just looking to improve their practice in an area, that they could also tap into a consulting teacher. So it was another example of how, again, my practice and the way I will approach this as well is to listen to what the community is saying, to learn from what I hear, and to shape my work going forward. So I want to thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to briefly introduce myself to you and share a little bit of my past professional background. And again, I'm happy to stay for questions if you feel like you have time or you'd like to.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We've got time for a couple of questions if people have them. Representative DeMuth. I didn't get that right, did I?
Thank you, Chair. It's DeMuth.
DeMuth. I'll work on it. My apologies.
That is no problem. Thank you, Commissioner, for sharing and getting to meet you today. I appreciate that. One question for you. Given your extensive background working with the educator unions, can you assure the committee how and if you will be able to be impartial to both labor and our locally elected school boards, the management?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative DeMuth.
Excellent.
I want to assure you that teaching and learning is my first concern, and students are at the center of teaching and learning. I picture education as, as concentric circles, where students are absolutely at the center, along with their families, and so meeting the needs of students and our families is my first priority. And then those concentric circles, how we surround our students, right? How do educators, our administrators surround those students and their families for that support? How do we as elected officials and as state workers surround the education workers, those paraprofessionals, those teachers, those principals, those assistant principals, counselors, how do we surround them to support them, knowing that they are doing the work of supporting students and their families? I see all of us looking inward into that, the center of teaching and learning, which is students and their families. Thank you for asking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Ricker, thank you for coming today. Welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
Two questions. You mentioned teaching, I believe it was middle school in St. Cloud. When was the last that you were actually in the classroom teaching? Because then you mentioned moving to the Federation.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Ricker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Juergens, thank you very much for asking. The last full-time teaching assignment I had was the 2004-2005 school year. I have been borrowing classrooms ever since. My last long continuous opportunity to do that was in 2014 when I renewed my board certification, and I borrowed a classroom for 3 months. And part of that was team teaching with the, you know, co-teaching with that teacher, and then taking on the teaching assignment myself, and then co-teaching with them again, so that, you know, sort of like gradual release, doing my own teaching, and then a gradual release back so that students had their full-time classroom teacher back. So that was 3 months in the spring of 2014. And then I stayed involved in that classroom, volunteering in that building. It was Humboldt Secondary for 2014-15 and 2015-16 as well, where I would be there every 1 to 2 weeks as my schedule allowed.
Is that indeed?
Okay. Yeah. Representative Juergens?
And as Commissioner of Education, mm-hmm. I know it's a daunting task. It's a large organization. Probably we don't have the budget targets yet, but $8-9 billion a year. I mean, it's going to be big.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So,
big ballpark.
How do you sleep at night? No, but given that, what else in your background? I don't know if anything can truly prepare you for a task like that. But what can you give us an idea in your background of what you feel has prepared you to take on a large task like that?
Commissioner Ricker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Juergens. I really appreciate you asking, because I do think daunting is the word that comes to mind. And I really feel like every experience I have had has prepared me differently for this. One of the highest levels of responsibility I ever felt was my daily classroom experience, where I had, you know, anywhere from 24 to 38 students looking me in the eye, expecting to be educated, right? And my standards posted on the wall, and I had, you know, 55 minutes or 67 minutes to like get through my lesson and check for understanding. And that is a daunting task. And it's a responsibility I take very seriously, and I carry deeply with me that feeling and that daily that feeling of what it's like to daily meet the needs of students. Also, being able to build partnerships with the community, with my administrators, both while I was a classroom teacher and alongside them as an advocate, I think prepared me really well to know that it takes multiple voices, that listening part, right? The richness of hearing from a diverse set of voices to learn from that, to shape the work going ahead, and to move that work ahead collectively, I think is an incredibly important part of this job, to recognize, one, the number of people in Minnesota officially and anecdotally who want our students to succeed is profound. And they are waiting to be asked. They're waiting to be heard. In many respects, they're not waiting to be asked or heard. And it's up to the Department of Education to catch up to where they are. And so I recognize that building those partnerships, listening to those diverse set of voices, is incredibly important to this as well. And I also recognize that there is a learning curve. I have incredible staff members at the Department of Education who have already committed to what that learning is. I have had incredibly gracious invitations and open doors for opportunities to sit and learn from the experts in the field in this room and in this body. And I believe that combination of things is really going to be the foundation of what helps all of us be successful, and me in this chair. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, and thanks again for coming today.
Commissioner, thank you very much for coming today. We get to move on now to some of your incredible staff.
Thank you. Yes.
So,
exactly.
Oh, can I have this question?
Can I get a question?
Oh, I didn't realize you wanted to be recognized.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, and congratulations on the job. A couple of things that I was, as I've been working on in early learning, as many of us have you had a chance to look at the interagency office that's in MD, I believe it's in the Department of Ed, the early learning office, and how that's going to interact?
Commissioner Ricker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kresha.
Kresha,
pardon me. Thank you for correcting me. Yes, I have. I've had the chance to sit down with the staff at MDE who work in early learning to talk through a series of things. Certainly, there was a general background discussion of the early learning grant opportunity that was recently announced, to also get some understanding of that, and also to make sure that I had an understanding of the landscape of early learning in the state of Minnesota.
Member Kresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what is your, as you're going through that, Commissioner, what is your understanding of the early learning landscape?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Ricker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the follow-up question. My understanding is that we have multiple delivery models right now. That I would also say my understanding is that there is a sincere, broad agreement that early learning is, you know, access to early learning is important, and that nobody quite feels like we are where we want to be with early learning yet, while everyone recognizes that we've made some incredible progress to getting where we are with our early learning opportunities for our students.
Representative Crusher.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And so I'm curious, you know, that's a very broad, and I understand early on assessment of it.
Yeah.
Where do we need to be?
Commissioner Rick, and this will be the last question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've got incredible staff waiting.
Thank you. Yes. My understanding is that we have, you know, how should I? I'll start with me first, recognizing that we need to make sure that access to early learning is available to everyone, that right now the barriers I have heard of are the cost of early learning, access to early learning in communities, as well as access to expanding early learning opportunities like seats themselves. So if those are the current barriers to making sure that everyone who wants an early learning opportunity for their child has one, then I understand that part of my responsibility is working together to determine how we break down those barriers, how we break down the barrier of cost, how we break down the barrier of, you know, expanding seats, if that's expanding space, or even identifying space, and if that's identifying, you know, just also qualified staff and access to it, whether that be distance or back to cost as well. But everyone who wants an early learning opportunity for their child should get one. And I think obviously there's been a lot of progress made getting there, but we're not there yet.
Okay. Commissioner, this apparently is that true Minnesota goodbye where we have to do it. A couple of times. I think that requires me to walk you to the door as well and, you know, wave goodbye.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I don't have bars then to leave with all of you that next time. Rookie mistake.
That is a expectation of freshmen who have their first bills up. We should have extended that communication to you and extended it to the commissioner. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah,
but thank you for taking the time today to come to committee, introduce yourself. It's not the last time you'll be here, so we'll have more time with you in the future, but I appreciate your taking the time today.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, point of clarification.
Yes.
And
Representative Kresha.
Thank you. I'm curious. I mean, I appreciate. Are we going to have time limits on all of our questions? I mean, I thought this was a good opportunity to have some more questions. Are we that compacted for time that we're going to limit questions?
Well, Representative Kresha, you asked to be identified after I'd excused the commissioner. And I allowed you to, out of deference to your position as the GOP lead, to ask not one, not two, but three questions. We do have work to do today. In addition to meeting the commissioner, many of the groups that have come before us, I'm sure your own school districts, mine, have all raised the issue of special education funding and the challenges that districts across the state are experiencing. The agenda has the department coming to present on that, and I wanted to move along so that we could have a substantive amount of time for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm, frankly, I'm a little surprised. I mean, I think that we've had a lot of collaboration through the years, and another 5 minutes wouldn't have put us off. I did raise my hand to be acknowledged. I'm sorry you didn't catch that before you excused the commissioner, but I, you know, we have conversations here. I wasn't trying to be anything other than I thought she was going down a very nice line on early childhood. I'd like to hear more about that. I'll just be honest, and for the record, I was a little surprised I was cut off at three. I would expect that the minority lead would get a little bit more deference. I know we've done that for you in the past. So just on the record, I'll say that.
Representative Krisha, I think I'm running the committee very much along the lines that I learned from Representative Loon, which is to be respectful of all members, but also respectful of the public and the testifiers coming before us and keeping us on time. Thank you. Dr. Melcher. Dr. Malpitcher, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Dabney and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of School Finance at the Department of Education. I also have Paul Farron with me, who is our special education funding supervisor, who may help me with some of the questions, and also Assistant Commissioner Darren Cordy if we have some program questions here. This morning, Mr. Chair and members, I have a PowerPoint that I want to walk you through that will describe recent trends in our enrollment of special education students, in the expenditures for special education, and in the funding for special education. And to the extent that we have time available, we also want to begin a discussion of the special education funding formula, including the old formula that we had in place, based on 2012 statutes, and the changes that were enacted in 2013 that led to a new formula being implemented in 2016, and what some of the problems and issues are that we faced with that and some potential solutions. So I know that you have time on the agenda both today and tomorrow to continue this discussion, so we put this all in one PowerPoint, and we thought we'd see as far as we could get today.
Very good. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to begin just by reviewing the recent trend in the total enrollment of special education students. This is the unduplicated December 1st child count. It includes both public and non-public school students. Our total count of special education students has grown from 115,000 in 2003 up to 147,000 this year. So we have a continuous growth in the number of students that are receiving special education services. We've had a fairly constant number of non-public school students, about 2,000, that are receiving special education services, and those they do receive shared time services from the public schools, and about 145,000 currently students receiving special education students who are public school students. You want to compare those trends in special education enrollment to the overall enrollment of our public schools. What you'll see is we've had a gradual increase from about 13.4% of the students being students with a disability in 2003 up to about 15% by 2011, and this year we're up to 16.3%. So we have seen some growth just in the last few years in terms of the percentage of students that are receiving special education services. If we look at this geographically, quite often in the department we like to look at the breakdowns by Minneapolis-St. Paul core cities, inner and outer ring suburban school districts. We look at large, medium, and small greater Minnesota districts, and we also look at charter schools and cooperatives. And what you can see from this is that of course, all districts across the state have special education students. The largest numbers of students are in our outer ring suburbs and the larger non-metro school districts. But one thing you'll notice here, if we compare 2012 and 2019, is that all of the different types of districts have seen increases in the number of special education students except for the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, where we've seen a decrease between 2012 and 2019. And I'll get into the reasons for that decrease here in a moment. If we look at the special education enrollment as a percentage of the total enrollment by district type, again, comparing 2012 and 2019, what you'll see is that historically the highest concentration of special education students was in our urban core cities in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But that's changed in the last few years. We currently have 16.6% of our students in Minneapolis and St. Paul are in special education, and that's very similar. 17.2% in our large non-metro districts, 17% in our medium-sized non-metro districts. The numbers are still a little bit smaller in the suburban school districts than they are in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But again, what you'll see here is an increasing percentage of all of our students receiving special education in every type of school district except the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, where the trend has been the opposite. And that, quite frankly, has to do with open enrollment kinds of situations. But the next slide I'd like to show you is the percentage of the resident special education population that is served outside of the school district. So in Minneapolis and St. Paul, what you can see is in 2012, 20% of the students with a disability were served outside of the resident district, either by a charter school, by a neighboring school district, or by an intermediate or cooperative type unit. That's grown in Minneapolis and St. Paul to almost 29% of the students who live in Minneapolis being served not by the Minneapolis Public Schools but by another agency, either a charter school or other district. You can also see that in every other category of school districts, we've also seen a similar pattern where fewer of the students are being educated by the resident school district and more of the students are being served outside of the district, either because of open enrollment or because of a cooperative or a charter school enrolling the students. Another trend that I've looked at is the resident special education students enrolled elsewhere as a percent of the enrollment in the district. And this becomes important because of the size of tuition bills that we see. So quite often, some of the residents of a school district are served outside of the district. Either the district or charter school providing the service receives funding to cover roughly 60 or 70% of the cost, and then they send a tuition bill to the resident district. And the resident district uses the money they get for other students in the system to help cover the cost of that tuition bill. So what this slide is showing you is that that's a more significant issue in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school district than in other districts, where 6.5 the special education count is 6.5% of the total enrollment in those districts, compared to somewhere between 3 to 4 to 5% in other districts. So that just means that when you're looking at the budget for a district like Minneapolis or St. Paul, that special education tuition bill is going to have to be paid out of a little bit smaller base, in the sense that there are fewer other students for each special education student that you're paying a bill for. Another trend that I find interesting is the enrollment of special education students by age. Of course, you'd expect that the numbers are quite small. Early childhood, it takes a little while to identify students that need services. We've seen some increases there as we have more young children being served. We're seeing some increases in the numbers of young children being served in special education. So at age 3, in 2012, we had 3,500 roughly special education students. Now at age 3, we have about 3,900. The special education enrollment peaks at about age 10 or age 11. We currently have 10,700 10-year-olds being served in special education. There's a little bit of a decline, actually, as students get into high school. By the time students are 17, we've got about 8,600 students enrolled. And then, of course, there's a sharp decline when students get to be 18. Most students graduate. But students can still receive special education services until they're 21 if they haven't graduated. And so even at age 21, we have 330 students being served. we look at the breakdown of special education enrollment by primary disability for this current school year, you can see that the largest category is specific learning disability. 22.9% of our special education students have that as a primary disability. The next largest categories are speech-language at 15.5%, autistic spectrum disorders at 13.9%, developmentally delayed, which is the early childhood population, at 13.3%, other health disabilities at 13.6%. We also have some very small categories that are very expensive. So physically impaired, for example, is only 1% of the population, but it's a category that has very high cost per student. I'd like to next talk about a little bit what some of the trends are in the number of special education students by primary disability. So here I've looked at where we were in 2013, where we were in 2016, where we are in 2019. So kind of taking three-year increments and seeing what the transitions have been. So the largest growth that we've seen since 2013 has been in the autistic spectrum disorder category, where we've grown from 15,900 students to about 20,400 students with autistic spectrum disorders as the primary disability. Developmentally delayed has also seen a very large increase from about 15,000 to about 19,000. And again, part of that may be due to earlier identification. As we have more students in contact with the public schools, we have more information and students are identified earlier.
Dr. Melcher, would you prefer to take questions as you go along, or are there inherent stopping points within your presentation that would make sense to delay questions for?
Mr. Chairman, if there are questions on these enrollments by disability, it might help. I've got a couple more slides, and then we could talk about that piece of it. And then there are some stopping points. Perhaps I could just stop periodically.
You signal at the appropriate spots.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me do two more slides, and then we'll kind of catch up to this point. Other areas that have a lot of growth in the system are specific learning disabilities and the EBD, emotional behavioral disabled category. There are some other categories that are more or less flat that have had some growth, and those include speech language, severely multiply impaired, visually impaired, deaf-blind, deaf hard of hearing, and traumatic brain injuries. You can see some of those categories are quite small in numbers, but for those students, it's a fairly expensive program. And then we have had three fairly large categories of special education services where we've seen declines over the last 6 years, and those include physically impaired, developmental cognitive severe, and developmental cognitive mild or moderate. And Mr. Chair, at this point, perhaps we could take questions on what the trends are in the enrollment of special education students.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. You're popular with the committee. Representative Richardson, you had a question.
Yes, looking at the data on autism spectrum disorder, because that increased over 13 and 16 and 19, is there any data that goes to whether those kids with that disability, are those educational assessments versus those who are being diagnosed within specialist systems? Is there a tracking for how many of those are school-related diagnoses?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Richardson, I'm looking over to our Assistant Commissioner Darren Cordy, who supervises the special education policy area. I believe he might have a better insight on that question than I would.
Assistant Commissioner Cordy, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Darren Cordy with the Department of Education, Assistant Commissioner. Thank you for the question, Representative Richardson. We do not track the specific diagnoses that a student would receive. Rather, the primary disability categories is reported to us by the school district. So that data would be maintained at the school level, or school district level, but we don't hold that at the department.
Representative Richardson, any follow-up? All right, thank you very much. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question for the testifier. Where would you categorize dyslexia? I know one in five students today in our public schools have that issue with the reading, and it's I think, was it last session, we also provided funding to the department for a dyslexia specialist to work with districts around the state. Where do you categorize dyslexia?
Mr. Corte.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. That would fall into the specific learning disability category. So we do have rules that identify exit and entrance criteria for each disability category. Under the specific learning disability category, one of the conditions that could rise to the level of being a specific learning disability would be dyslexia, and that's actually listed in the rule. Now, I want to be clear that not every student who has dyslexia would necessarily qualify for special education services under a specific learning disability. There may be other reading interventions short of special education services that they require, but to the extent that you had a student that had such severe dyslexia that it would qualify them for special education services, that would be under the specific learning disability category.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up, would the department be able to come back to the committee sometimes to just explain what's going on with the new person that's on staff that's working with the districts, and what can districts do to get help with training their teachers to how to help students learn how to read?
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, absolutely. We do have a dyslexia specialist on board. She's a licensed clinical psychologist with specializing in reading disorders and dyslexia. She has children with dyslexia herself. In fact, I think she may have appeared in front of this committee in prior years. So we'd be happy to have her come in and speak to her expertise around this area.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Yuking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is to, I don't know if it's to Dr. Melcher or Mr. Cordy. What happens, so you say, are you slotting these kids as primary disability? Because there's a lot of children, I just finished working in a school at the end of December, where they have an ASD diagnosis, but they're in the EBD classroom. So what are you doing with multiple diagnosis? Is it a primary first that ends up being tracked, or how is that tracked?
Mr. Cordy.
Okay.
Quoting a friend here.
Sorry, I guessed wrong.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Paul Fair, and I supervise the special education data and funding formula. Mr. Chair, thank you, representatives. The Department of Education, similar with the IEP, where it just states the primary disability for any student, all we receive in is also that primary disability. We don't get the full IEP unless it's on a monitoring or program side where they're individually requesting. Other than that, we don't see the documents for the other 147,000 some odd students, roughly.
Representative Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up. That makes sense then, because I think if things were tracking in a secondary, I think you'd see a much bigger spike in the EBD area, because most districts are shuttling kids between, like they'll have an LD classroom and an EBD classroom, but some of those kids free flow between the two depending on what's happening and how the IEP is changing. But some of the trends I think some of the teachers are seeing in different districts are a lot more students are funneling into the EBD classroom because of maybe mental health issues versus a diagnosis. So, you can only do as good as the data you're getting. So thank you.
Any response, Mr. Farron? Or?
Aside from, I completely agree on, especially that with, for my side, and how the tuition billing and calculating rates go, that I only see the primary disability of the student. Speech services are provided to a lot of the different varieties, but development delay generally gets a lot of the service, autism kids, the DCD kids, and for schools who code the cost entirely as I have a speech teacher, pathologist, I code them 100% to speech, it skews the rates for the services when trying to bill out for serving an autism kid, a DCD kid, and it's similar, we get that with the other health disabilities and the EBD, where a lot of times they're in the same classroom and the teacher's only coded to one side. And so we do a lot of presentation, a lot of trainings and working with schools to accurately report the cost as based on the students being served, so that at least then rates start to try to look a little more reflective of where they should be.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate these numbers. I'm interested in looking at them, but I always want to drill down and find out why. Why are the numbers changing? And hopefully we'll get to some of that. But on page 11, I don't think the scale does this justice. I did some quick math here, and with the autistic spectrum, it increased 28% in 6 years, and so did the developmentally delayed. If that trend continues for another 6 years, you're looking at over 26,000 students that fall into that category. That's got to be concerning for all of us. Do you have any data to Representative Joachim touched on a little bit, but do you have any data that would give us some answers as to why we're seeing such a drastic increase, and is there anything, what can we do to stem that a little bit in the next 6 years?
Mr. Corte.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Juergens. There's a number of factors that play into why we believe that ASD rates are going up. One is just that enrollment is going up across the board. So that's going to account for part of that. Is just as you have more students entering the system, you're going to have more students, that have ASD entering the system. Part of it is that school districts are doing a better job of identifying students who require services for autism spectrum disorder. And then I think the third piece is that parents are becoming more aware of their rights and abilities to request services from districts, to request an evaluation, and if a district doesn't necessarily do an evaluation, as Representative Richardson said, there's an ability for them to go outside and get a private evaluation that may lead to a diagnosis, which could require services as well. There is research out there about, physiological and neurological reasons why there may be increases in that. We can't speak to that, but there are researchers who have done work on that, and we can certainly share that with the committee. But we do know that those three factors, just enrollment generally, awareness, and then better jobs identifying are part of the reasons why we're seeing increases in those areas.
Representative Juergens?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Sandell, did you have a question for the testifiers?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and gentlemen. Representative Juergens kind of anticipated my questions as well, asking why when we see all these numbers is really is the question that jumps out at me. Taking a look at the numbers of special enrollment students or special ed enrollment students from fiscal 03 to fiscal 19, there's about a 20% increase in the numbers of students who are being served. And my question, I guess, as Representative Juergens' question is, why is such a dramatic increase over these years being represented here?
Mr. Corte?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think some of the items that I mentioned before with ASD generally probably apply here as well. And I'm sure that you have district folks coming in as well. I think it'd be helpful to hear from them to see what the reasons that they are hearing on the ground, because they're the ones doing the identifications, not us. We just have the criteria. So the criteria hasn't changed basically in the last decade, yet we're seeing these numbers go up. So it's not a function of the law changing or the rules changing. It's something that's happening within our communities, and I think districts would probably be in a better situation to speak to that individually than we would.
For the committee, to Mr. Corte's point about listening to district people, we do have a panel of superintendents coming in tomorrow to speak to the issue of special education, and they may be able to answer the questions or respond differently to the question from their perspective.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Hewitt. Representative Hewitt, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to step out for a second, but page 9, I just have a question for clarification. You have at the age 17, 18, 8,000 some, and then it drops off. Is the dropout rate brought into this at all as far as the kids just not continuing education at that point or no?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, some of the students have graduated when they're 17, so they're no longer in school when they're 18.
Right.
But this would be just a count of the number of students that are enrolled on December 1 that are in the public school system at that time and how many there are. So there may be some that have dropped out, and that would certainly be reflected in the rates as students get to be 17 years old. But I think some of it is that you just have some students who are no longer being served in special education late in their high school career. Maybe they had a speech-language issue and it was corrected, and now they're no longer in the system. but some of it may also be drop-off, yes.
Mr. Farron, do you have perspective to share on this? And if you would, please come to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. So it is December 1, which also it's the age of the student on December 1. So we are generally, since we're barely 3-4 months into the school year, not that many students have hit the age of 18 yet, which is why we end up having more at 17, and then they've graduated before they would have actually, we'd count them the following December when they would be 18.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, is there any metric that tracks that, the kids that are in special ed that actually drop out?
Mr. Farron?
Yes, we would have, we would have metrics for number of special ed students who drop out at given certain ages.
Mr. Chair, sir, I would like to see that at some time, if you could share that with us at one point or another. Thank you.
Perhaps the department could share broader information on dropout rates beyond special ed, if that.
Right. That'd be great.
We'd appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either or any of the three, do districts record their 405s? Do they have to submit that information to special education? Because 405s are, at least when I was still teaching, are very popular between that age of 12 and 17. So is that data recorded?
Representative Erickson, can you define for the committee 405?
Well, that would be a special intervention that is determined by a teacher team and a 504, excuse me.
Okay,
not a 405.
Thank you.
504, excuse me.
That's why I asked.
I have dyslexia. Yeah, it's been a while since I've been there. Yeah, 504, so I'm
okay.
Sorry, not 405.
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, members, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, we do collect student demographic data for students who are who have a Section 504 plan. So would be happy to report that data to the committee as well.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer, did you want back in? Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Melcher, where did we drop off? Which slide?
We dropped off at the end of the enrollment data, and we'll move next to slide 14, which is where we begin talking about expenditure trends. So, Mr. Chair and members, I'll proceed.
Thank you.
So what this pie chart is showing, Mr. Chair and members, is the breakdown of special education expenditures by object. So there were $2.39 billion spent on special education in fiscal year 18. Of that amount, about 61% was for salaries. About 20% was for fringe. So we're talking, obviously very labor-intensive here, 81% of the total expenditures for special education being for salaries and fringe. Then we had roughly 12% was for transportation, and that includes special education transportation. Those are for students where special transportation needs were identified in the IEP. But our special education funding formula also provides funding for transportation for homeless students,
504 plan.
And care and treatment. So that's about 1.8% of the total cost that's going into the special education formula is for other high-cost transportation that's not special education per se. And then we have about 2.5% of the cost that's covered in the special education formula is for the alternative delivery of specialized instructional services, sometimes called ADSIS. And that's a program for young children who are falling behind and may at some point need special education services as kind of a way of perhaps preventing that situation and trying to catch those students early. And then we also have other costs for special education, things like supplies, materials, equipment, about 2.4% of the total. And Mr. Chair, if there are questions, I'd be happy to take them on each slide as we go through, if that is preferred.
Representative Sandstead, ask and you shall receive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, can you please explain fringe one more time?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Sansi, that would be health insurance, life insurance, retirement,
benefits.
Pensions, yeah.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Or Representative Sanseed, I'm just a mess here today.
That's okay. Dr. Melcher, ADSIS, this is a term I'm not familiar with. Is this a is this available statewide?
Yes.
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanseed, yes, this is a state program that allows school districts to apply to receive funds to use state special education dollars to provide interventions for children who may be at risk of being identified as needing special education services. So it's a program we have in statute. It's administered through the apartment. School districts apply to us with a plan and a budget on how they're planning on using that money, and any school district can apply for that.
Representative Sanseed?
Thank you. Last question. Not right at this moment. Can we get a breakdown of maybe school districts that are utilizing this?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Melcher, you referred to care and treatment as being in these expenses somewhere. Can you just elaborate a little bit on what that means, please?
Mr. Chairman, members, in the other transportation category, that 1.8% includes transportation expenses for students that are in care and treatment, also homeless students, and students with a 504 plan, as well as special education students. And so I think the background for that is those types of transportation are pretty unique on an individual student basis. They're high cost, so I think the legislature at some point in time decided that since those were relatively high cost services, kind of on an individual basis, that they could appropriately be funded in the same manner as special education transportation.
All right. Thank you. Please continue.
Pardon me? Madam Chair and members, Mr. Farron has just looked up a number of school districts that have an ADSIS program. It's 173 right now. So roughly half of our school districts. We can provide you with a list as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chair and members, the next slide is showing the expenditures eligible for state and federal special education aid, how those have changed since 2003. In 2003, and this is the blue line is in current dollars. The red line is inflation-adjusted dollars. So the cost of special education is growing at quite a bit faster rate than the rate of inflation. So in inflation-adjusted dollars, we have increased from $1.6 billion roughly to $2.4 billion roughly during those 15 years in terms of the inflation-adjusted expenditures for special education. If we look at the breakdown of special education expenditures in terms of the special education program costs, the ADSIS that we just talked about, and the transportation piece, this is giving you a look in 2006, 2012, and 2018. And as you can see, most of the cost is the salaries and fringe for special education staff. ADSIS did not begin until 2007, so you don't see any number there for 2006. But it has grown fairly quickly, still a small part, but accounts for $59 million in 2018. And then you can see the transportation portion is the orange part on top, and that also has seen a fairly significant rate of growth, especially between 2012 and 2018. We can also look at the average cost of special education per special education student. And again, the blue line here is the cost in current dollars. The red line is after adjusting for inflation using the Consumer Price Index. So what you'll see is there has been a modest amount of increase in the cost per student for special education even after you adjust for inflation. So currently, on the average, the cost per special education student for special education services is about $14,430. Obviously, there's a wide variation, but that's the average that we're looking at currently.
Dr. Melcher, yes. One moment. Representative Katiza-Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm hopeful to clarify. You mentioned that ADSIS began in 2007.
Yes.
So over the last decade plus, what sort of reporting do we have based on the results of this funding for these students who are at risk for to be classified as special ed students, and kind of what are we keeping them out of that classification? And I'd just be interested to learn a little bit more. Thank you.
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do have data. Each district that applies and receives funding does submit evaluation data back to us. We'd be happy to share that with the committee. I believe we put together a report every year. In terms of, you know, being able to determine quantifiably whether or not it prevented a student from being identified as having a disability, I'm not sure that we get it down to that level, but we can at least show you what the districts are reporting back to us.
Very good. Representative Edelson.
Hi, I'm going to go back to, thank you, Chair. I'm going to go back to slide 10, and just looking at this, I agree with the representative. I can't see your name across there with gray coat on. In terms of looking at the scope of what we're going to be dealing with the number of kids coming into our system, the increase of students being identified as needing special education, it's overwhelming. And I look at the specific learning disability, and really what I would love to see is a breakdown of what that looks like, because there could be a specific, my kids have, they qualify for special education. I have twins that have specific learning disabilities. They have it in reading and math. They actually qualify under the dyslexia category. But I would love to see what that looks like, because I think we really have to start dissecting what we're seeing an increase on. And then the developmentally delayed, really to dive into both of those categories, which are quite big. So thank you.
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, absolutely. We can have a conversation about that. As Mr. Farron mentioned, districts only report to us the primary disability category, not kind of the underlying work on that. But we do also go through IEPs as part of our program monitoring process, and so we could chat with our monitoring team and see the kind of data that they have, or also work with the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education organization and see if they've gathered that type of data. In terms of developmental delay, Ms. Gilbert from St. Paul reminded me that there have been some changes in statute around requirements for when a student needs to receive early childhood special education services. So there have been some things added to statute over the years. For example, if a student is in foster care, they're now eligible to receive early childhood special education services. So that identification has partially contributed to the increase that we've seen in the developmental delay category, since that is primarily in that early childhood ages.
Representative Edelson, excuse me.
Thank you. That I would love to see if we can find some more information in terms of looking at the desegregation of the data. Thank you.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other day, Mr. Strom gave us some numbers statewide, the total cost for educating a child when you figure in the federal dollars, mm-hmm. fees, and local levies, was around $14,700. On page 17, in adjusted for inflation dollars of $14,430. Now, that's not going to be added on top, because there's some fees and some levies that are going to be included in there. But do we have an average of what the total cost for special education per student is?
Who wants that question? Dr. Melcher does, according to Mr. Strom.
This is not simply adding it up.
Mr. Strom.
Nothing is, Representative Juergens.
And Representative Dr. Melcher. Juergens. Slide 17 is showing you the average special education expenditure per special education student. So this is the cost of the additional students, special education, the additional services those students receive in special education. So for those students, most of them are also receiving regular education for a part of the day, or in some cases most of the day. And so you would need to take this $14,000 for special education cost and add to it the cost of serving that student in the regular classroom as well to get a total cost for serving those students.
Representative Juergens.
No, that's fine. Thank
All
you.
All right. Thank you. If you would continue.
Yes, and Mr. Chair and members, slide 18 is giving you a breakdown of the average cost per special education student. And again, this is just the cost of special education. It is not the total cost of education, because these students are served primarily in the regular classroom and also receive services in the special education program. But as you can see here, there's quite a variation among school district types. in the cost of special education, and I tried to show you 3 years so you can see what those trends are. And one of the trends that I find striking is, well, first of all, you see an increase in the average cost per student in every single one of the categories, but you see a lot larger increase in the average cost in the charter school category and in the cooperatives, which would also include the intermediate category. So, for example, for cooperatives and intermediates, the average cost of special education has grown from $29,500 in 2007 to $45,208 in 2018. And in charter schools, the cost has roughly doubled from $8,939 to $17,937. Now, other types of school districts have also seen increases, but nothing on that order of magnitude. So I don't know if we have data that would describe kind of some of the underlying causes of those increases. Certainly we know that our cooperatives tend to serve the students with the most challenging disabilities, and the cost of some of those programs has grown very very rapidly. But just to share with you how this does vary across regions.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I'd also like to talk a little about...
Dr. Melcher, I'm sorry if I can stop you. Representative Kunesh-Padin.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I was looking at and wondering the same thing that you just mentioned about the charter schools, the cooperative, and other. Are you finding perhaps that some of these charter schools and cooperative, and you mentioned that the cooperatives are kind of created to help some of the students that have the most, you know, social emotional issues. Charter schools, do you find that there is a trend where some of these charter schools are addressing specifically student with autism or special or let's say unique learning styles? I visited Avalon School here in St. Paul and a couple others that deal with students that have, you know, need a less rigorous or less confining environment, as well as a more exploratory way of learning. Do you find that there are more? Do you know if there are more charter schools that are going with that sort of a mission for students, and that might be the reason why charter schools are off? Or are you just finding that as charter schools are getting more, I want to say sophisticated or more detailed in what they're doing, that they're finding that they have more and more opportunities to work with kids that are having those learning issues?
Dr. Melcher, Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kunesh-Padin, I think you're right on the first part, that there has been an increase in the number of charter schools that focus on serving students primarily with disabilities. I can think of a handful of schools off the top of my head that do have very high, if not 100% enrollment of students receiving special education services, and you're correct, some of them focus on specific disability categories such as autism or Metro Deaf School, for example, is another one. So that is something that we've seen an increase as well. In terms of the cooperatives and intermediates, we have had a large push statewide to make sure that students are being educated in the most integrated setting possible, and I think part of what you're seeing with intermediates, and certainly their superintendents would be able to speak to this better, that the extremely challenging students that they receive in the past may not have been served by a district or an intermediate district. They may have received homebound instruction just because the district or intermediate just didn't have the capacity to serve them at all. So the intermediates especially have really made an effort to keep those kids in school and keep them in full-time settings rather than homebound settings. So I think part of that contributes to it. But in terms of the actual cost, I think the superintendents would be best able to speak to that.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and members, the next thing I wanted to do was review some of the trends in the cost per student by primary disability area. And these are rank ordered from the most expensive to the least expensive. So the developmental, cognitive, severe, profound has the highest cost. The cost has not changed dramatically over the last 11 years. Some of the others that have very high cost are visually impaired, physically impaired, developmental, cognitive, mild, moderate, deaf-blind, as you would expect. Some of these you'll see, like deaf-blind, for example, had a relatively low cost in 2007, and some of that may have been due to some difficulties we had back at that time in sorting out the data or some of the data reporting. So we think we have better numbers now than we did in 2007, and part of that increase, I think you'll also see that in the autism area, where we're getting a little bit better data reported by the districts than we had in 2007. Severely multiply impaired is another one where the cost growth from 9,800 to 19,000 is partly that's not just because the cost of serving those students went up, it's because school districts are doing a better job of identifying what those costs are. And sometimes it's very difficult if a student is being served in multiple areas to identify where do you record the expenses of serving the child. Going down the list, you can see that some other disability areas have a little bit lower cost. Speech language is one of those that has relatively low cost. Traumatic brain injury also is low, although that may be a data reporting kind of an issue there as well. So it just, again, it gives you a general sense of what the costs, how they vary among the disability categories, and the special education funding formula does use some of this data, so I'll get into in a moment. The next slide is trying to take the special education costs and get a better handle on what's making up that cost and how has that changed over time. So this is looking at what portion of the salaries for special education are going for teachers versus other licensed professionals versus administrators versus non-licensed staff. And what we're seeing, the trend is that we're seeing a smaller portion of the salary dollar going for teachers and other licensed professionals, and a larger portion going for administration and especially for the non-licensed staff. So we're seeing more paraprofessionals being used in the overall mix, as an example, than we did 11 years ago.
Dr. Melcher, one moment. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just when you said that, I think we all noticed when you're looking at the cost in that chart, there was a little bit of a dip at the end. So so when I look at the two together, I wonder if it's due to the fact that we're having more non-licensed professionals being able to fill a need, and what was the reason for the dip of the, am I reading it wrong about the dip in the chart and tying it to what you've just shown us here?
So we're looking at, I believe, at this chart 17 here, which showed that there was, the cost per child is growing every year, but the cost in relation to inflation is maybe going down a little bit. And I don't think we have data on that would identify how this staffing mix has varied. I think what we're seeing with the increase in the non-licensed cost is that school districts are just employing more non-licensed staff. There are more students in their IEP that have identified a paraprofessional as being an element that student needs, and so that's driving up the percentage of the total salary bill that's going for the non-licensed staff. I don't think they're necessarily replacing teachers. I think they're in addition to the teaching staff.
Anything else, Representative Pryor? Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, having left the classroom a month ago, do you have an explanation why we would see an increase in administrative costs and a decrease in some, like the teacher and perhaps non-licensed? I certainly understand the increase in the non-licensed areas like paras and the additional hands-on. Do you have any explanation around the administrative increase?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Stansted, no, I don't. We're just kind of pulling the data out of the system and just beginning to look at the analysis. I would say that the cost for teachers is growing, the cost for other licensed staff is growing. So you're seeing these dips in percentages, but the actual number of teachers is growing. The next slide gives you a little bit of a breakdown, I think, that might help illuminate this a little bit more. And what this does is identify the breakdown between teachers, administrators, other licensed and non-licensed based on area of the state or type of school. And so what you can see is that, for example, cost in charter schools is higher as a percentage. Those tend to be smaller programs. So the cost is very low in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So you've got very large programs. You can be a little bit more cost-effective in terms of your administrative budget when you've got a large population of students. If you're in a charter school, relatively small, cost of administration might be higher. So as we're seeing a shift from school district programs to charter school programs, part of that might be picking up in the administration area. Suburban metro districts also, though, have relatively high cost for administration in relation to. But we'd have to do a little more digging in terms of what the – this is just kind of taking the pie and breaking it down into percentages and not looking at the absolute value. But we could certainly do more research on that if that would be helpful.
Reverend Sanstead. Dr. Melcher, looking at maybe another 5, 6, 7 minutes, we have the ever-important job of approving the minutes of the last meeting to get done before we finish up today.
I think we're at a good transition point here, Mr. Chair. If I could just do a couple more slides, I think we'll be good.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to say a couple more things about this particular slide, and what you'll see is that the there's quite a difference between the cost structure in charter schools versus school districts. And if you look at the teacher category, you'll see that's between 41% and 43% for all types of school districts across the state, big, small, metro, rural, 41% to 43%. Charter schools, 29.7% of the budget is for teacher salaries. If you look at other license, what you'll see is relatively high cost in the metro area for other licensed. Metro school districts are using more of the non-teaching professional staff, lower cost in the rural districts and in the charter schools. And then in the non-licensed area, you'll see, again, a much higher percentage of the total budget is in charter schools, 37%. So the cost for paraprofessionals in charter schools is higher than the cost for teachers, which is just the reverse of what it is in the metro area school districts. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just do one more slide. This is kind of the intro to the funding side of things. So what this slide shows is the trend in total expenditures for special education in millions of dollars. So from fiscal year 2003 to fiscal year 2023, this is based on November forecast, cost of special education is growing from $1.2 billion to $3 billion statewide. The area in blue at the bottom is the portion that is picked up by federal aid. It's roughly $182 million in fiscal year 23, and you can see it's been pretty flat at roughly $180 million for several years. You'll see the green portion is the part that is being picked up by the state, and the state share is growing pretty rapidly from $724 million in 2003 up to about $2 billion we're projecting in fiscal year 23. And just between the current year, fiscal 19 and fiscal 23, we're projecting the cost to grow from $1.6 billion to $2 billion, so $400 million. And then the red is the cross-subsidy. So what you're seeing there is just a gradual increase in the cross-subsidy. We're currently at $724 million statewide. Under current law, if we just keep appropriating dollars to fund the current formula and the trends stay the same as they are, we're projecting the cross-subsidy will grow to $858 million by 2023. And so, Mr. Chair, I think that's a fairly good stopping point. The slides after this get into more detail on the cross-subsidy and the mechanics of the funding formula.
And that's just our preview of coming attractions tomorrow. All right. Thank you, Dr. Melcher, Mr. Farron, and Mr. Corte. I appreciate your time today. Representative Juergens, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to ask any more questions, but this is more of an observation. I asked earlier about the chart on page 11, which shows the increase in students, specifically the autistic spectrum, that has increased 28% in 6 years. And then if you go to page 20, the years don't exactly match up, but in addition to the number of students increasing 28%, the actual cost per student is increasing 37%. So it's just an observation. If we were running a business, that would be something that would concern us, and I think it should as well in this committee.
Yes. Thank you very much. Representative Youakim, have you had a chance to look at the minutes of our fifth meeting on January 24th?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair, and I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Youakim motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, as indicated, the department will be back tomorrow to complete the slide deck and the exploration of special education services and costs, as well as having a superintendent panel tomorrow to bring that perspective. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very much.